Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon to everyone. I'm going to do a quick roll call. On today's call, we have Michele Nylon, Barbara Steele, James Bledel, Miriam Trudell, Kevin Erdman, Mike O'Connor, Anil George, Paul Diaz, Tim Ruiz, Michael Collin, and from staff we have Marika Konings, Glenn de Saint-Géry, Olaf Nordling, Dave Piscitillo, William McKelligott, and if I could just remind everyone to please state their names when they speak for the accuracy of the transcript. Thank you very much.
Okay. Did you all get a chance to have a look at the agenda for this afternoon's call? Okay. Dave Piscitillo has taken some time out, and I believe Dave is going to go over some of the SSAC's findings. And then after Dave's done that, then we'll move on to some of the other points on the agenda. Dave, would you like to kick off there, please?
Okay. Are you speaking of the from the 2005 hijacking report, or are you more interested in the relationship of the more recent report that SSAC published on protective measures?
I think the thing is, some people on this call would be very familiar with issues going back as far as 2005 and beyond, whereas some other people are kind of new to some of the topics here. So in some respects, I think you need to kind of work on the basis that we might learn quickly, but don't presume that people know everything from the get-go, if that makes any sense. Dave, can you hear me?
Dave, we can't hear you. He's still as listed as connected, but...
Okay, so it's not just me.
No, I can't hear him either. This is Mikey.
Okay. While Dave deals with his technical difficulties, let's move on then, I suppose. Dave, if you can hear us. Marika, can you call Dave or something?
Yeah, I'm jabbering him, so he seems to be aware that he has an issue, but I think he hasn't figured out yet how to solve it. To kick it off, I can maybe just briefly take people through the two slides that are up here introducing the issue.
Okay.
Or do you first want to go to some of the other items on the agenda?
Does anybody have a preference? I honestly don't mind one way or the other.
Okay. I'd say let's carry on and see if Dave can rejoin.
So should we look at the slides that we have up there and let Marika go through those for us?
Yeah. Sounds like very fine to me.
And Dave's trying to dial back in. So just very briefly, issue A looks at whether an expedited handling process should be developed for fraud situations. So the report highlights there a number of suggestions that were made in a staff report in 2005 after this issue was raised in a public comment period. And there a number of issues were considered or raised as possible steps, such as indeed developing an expedited handling process, looking at automatically returning names that are subject to a dispute until the dispute has been resolved, or automatically rolling back the name servers. As the ASSAC produced a hijacking report, and I'll wait for Dave to return to talk a bit more about that, in which they provided some more details about how such a process could look like, and they highlighted some elements of the emergency action channel, a companion policy to this emergency action channel, and a public awareness campaign that could go with that, so that people are aware that it's a way they could address problems in this area.
Hi,
so
David,
some of the questions that we identified in the issues report that might need further consideration is, like, what is the extent of this problem? Does it actually warrant the development of a separate policy, or is it currently better served by interaction between registrars that might be able to handle these kind of situations in a quicker way? Is it maybe better to have best practices instead of a policy? How do you ensure a fair process? How do you avoid that people might invoke this procedure just to stall return of a domain name or to hold on to a domain name that's not theirs? Who would be in the end the decision maker, whether a domain name has actually been hijacked or was it a proper transfer? And are there any market solutions or best practices that already exist that might address this issue? I don't know, Dave, are you already back on the call?
Yeah, I'm back on the call. I'm sorry. I was using voice over IP and my provider is having some problems today. It's a very bad latency. So I switched to a landline. I hope that solves the problem. Do you want me to – I guess I should probably start from the beginning. I have no idea what you heard and did not hear.
Yeah, probably. What I just did, I just quickly went over the slides that are up and just talked a little bit about the recommendation, the staff report, and some of the questions that the group might want to consider in relation to this question. I just briefly mentioned the ESSEC report, but I didn't go into any details of the recommendations you made there. So I'll hand it back to you on that one.
Okay. Again, apologies for the disconnect. So there are actually two relevant data points and reference points with respect to ESSEC's interest in domain transfers, and both focus primarily on unauthorized transfers resulting from some form of hijacking or some form of unauthorized access to a domain registration account. In 2005, we actually wrote a report called Domain Name Hijacking, Incidents, Threats, Risks, and Remedial Actions. And in that report, what we focused on were some high-profile incidents where a domain account was accessed without authorization, and either the domain was it modified in such a way where the DNS configuration pointed an otherwise legitimate user to an impersonation site or to a defacement site. And from some of those incidents, one of the things that we observed was that some of the victimized registrants experienced what they considered very, very, very long delays in actually getting their name back. Very much like a phishing attack, one of the sort of metrics that people consider in terms of restoring service when business is interrupted is something measured in minutes and hours, not measured in days. And so one of the goals that ESSEC had, without pointing fingers at anyone, was that it would be useful if there were some guidelines that would allow registrars to acknowledge that there's been a malicious act and restore a domain and restore what we call the last working configuration. So that the victimized party could restore his business service and continue his business following the interruption without a problem. We felt that was not addressed adequately in the existing policy and contract, so we encouraged the community to study this issue. I don't think there's very much point in going into very much more detail than that from the 2005 report. Our focus was primarily on what we would consider a similar activity to a form of accelerated suspension in the case of a well-documented and identified domain used for phishing or illegal pharmaceuticals or some other malicious act. Just recently, we published a report called SAC number 40, and it's called "Protect Messengers to Protect Registrants from Malicious Use or Exploitation of Their Domain Registration Accounts." And in that document, we actually focus less on the transfer policy and more on measures that registrars could consider and encourage registrants to employ as well that would prevent or at least seriously reduce the opportunity for an attacker to compromise a domain name account and either do some sort of malicious alteration of DNS or change of contact for a subsequent attempt at a registrar transfer, registration transfer rather. I'm not certain how much more you want to know about what we've done. In SAC 40, we talk about things like stronger registration verification processes, the use of perhaps multiple party confirmation before one would accept a DNS configuration, or multi-party confirmation before one would allow a transfer to progress. And so the model here is very similar to the kind of 1950s movie where you have, or even GoldenEye, if you remember the James Bond movie, where you have to have two people with complementary keys before you actually can launch a missile. And in this particular case, it would be two people who would have to in some way proactively respond and confirm before a registrar would begin or accept a transfer transfer of a domain. There are some other measures that talk about things like multi-factor authentication, having the registrar either through an opt-in or some other kind of method provide provide assurance that the registrant identifies a unique party for administrative contact, a unique party for registrant, a unique party for technical administrator. We also talk about using methods other than electronic mail and making them available perhaps as an option or an additional service for a registrant so that the registrant could say, in the event that I do get hijacked, it is very possible that the attacker might modify my my mail records in my DNS and then I won't get electronic mail. So one of the things that I might want to do is take note that I want you to, I want the registrar to contact me using some non-email method, either an instant message or a phone call or some other method. So the report is fairly fairly detailed in providing a very long item list of possible measures that have been used in other other vertical markets like the financial markets or like secure enterprise intranets to provide stronger measures at the gate, so to speak, to seriously reduce the opportunity for intrusions that lead to hijacking. And much less emphasis is placed on looking at the transfer element other than the fact that that is one of the activities that we would thwart if we had stronger verification measures and stronger confirmation metrics and measures.
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions?
This is Kevin Erdman. One thing that struck me as I was looking at the report and then listening to your description is whether there are, in addition to the technical means to try to protect things and add security and verification and all that, are there technical ways that one might be able to determine the difference between a valid transfer and a hijacking type of case? For instance, different traffic patterns causing some erratic behavior in terms of what the use of the website was originally prior to the transfer and then after the transfer?
I don't know of any study that's been done in that area of anomaly detection. And if you think of the pause for a second and think of the broad scope of the way domain names are used from tasting all the way to someone who's had a domain since the John Postel writing it on a napkin era. You could come up with a set of potential markers that used in combination would give you maybe a fingerprint of some sort of malicious activity. I think that they would be very hard to hard to formulate. My guess is that a better I'd speculate that a perhaps a more fruitful way to invest some research would be to go to some of the people who would be most concerned about the transfer of what they believe is an asset, like eBay or PayPal or Amazon, and ask them what specific measures they might consider. And that's one of the things that ESAC did in its report. And I think preventative measures are complementary to what you are attempting to do with improving the transfer process. I mean, as we reduce the opportunity to break in, we also reduce the opportunity to actually do some sort of malicious act. One of the things that you could look at is the quality of the registration contact information. As an example, if I'm transferring a domain that has been held by a party for many, many years, and the domain registration data is complete and to the best of the registrar's ability to deduce accurate, and then it's being transferred to a party where they haven't provided what looks like or what is interpreted as a correct phone number or the address is the address is not complete and the email address doesn't actually or you could check to see if the email address is active and it's not, or it's in a Gmail or a Hotmail or some other or some spam domain like 123xyz456 a.cn. You could probably start to put together that sort of analysis, but I don't know of anyone who's actually done something like that yet. Perhaps one of the larger registrars might be looking into that in their abuse research, but nothing that I know has been surfaced yet.
Anybody else have any other questions or comments?
I have a question.
There's hands up, Michele.
Sorry.
There's Mikey and Tim.
With Michael.
Okay, we'll take Mikey first then.
This is Mikey O'Connor. Dave, just to clarify, is it safe to say then that ESAC is sort of leaning away from the 2005 Emergency Action Channel recommendation and leaning more towards stronger security, multi-factor identification, et cetera?
I think they're complementary, Mike. Security is always about multiple lines of defense and multiple lines of detection. So you do as much as you can to keep intruders out. But once the intruders, once the intruder's in, you don't want to just let him have free access. And if he manages to steal something, hijacking is in some context a theft, you want to be able to provide provide the victim with some recourse. And so I wouldn't characterize ESSEC as saying if you do everything up front, you don't have to worry about anything in the back. Because no matter how good the defenses are, there's always the possibility of social engineering or coercion or some other manipulation of a domain registration account that could result in an unauthorized party doing something with the domains he now has control over. So I think that, and I think that in a very simple business case like the one with Panics or with ICANN.org, the domain is misused. In a much more complicated case, the domain is put in a limbo state, and perhaps it's not just an attacker, but it's some sort of situation where a customer of an ISP has registered a domain. The ISP decides the domain has some sort of value, and he's not particularly decent guy, and he's registered it on behalf of the customer. And now you have an issue where you have to work a little bit harder. But in the meantime, there's just been an argument over the phone, and the ISP is a small guy, and he just goes and he changes the domain and moves it to Parked or to whatever else he wants. Now the guy who's running Alice's banana factory is not not selling bananas. And I think that there is an appropriate appropriate course other than lots of money and lots of time elapsed.
This is Mikey again. If I could just ask one follow up question for Dave. Looking at Marika's slide, there are sort of four pretty tasty questions, the extent of the problem, how to ensure a fair process, who would be the decision maker, and which market solutions or best practices already exist. Does ESSAC have any opinions about those questions at this point that we don't already have available in the form of the reports?
I would honestly say that ESSAC has not looked at these questions. I think that there are some models that are emerging in the area of accelerated suspension processes that have come out of some work between registrars and the APWG that might be applicable here. I think my personal view, and this is not an ESSAC view or an ICANN view, is that there is room in the domain name world for an accredited intervener. And it's a trusted party that either through bonding or through certification or some other mechanism, registrars can all have relatively high confidence is going to present them with legitimate as opposed to specious cases. And if we could agree on such a model where there are people we trust who are going to go and do the work, and much in the way that we trust attorneys. And accountants to provide us with accurate information, then I think that those are the kinds of people that we should recognize as and use to provide some of the aspects of the fair process. So if I had someone I could go to, much in the way that many of the brand owners use companies like Internet Identity or some of the registrars who provide online brand protection, go and say, I want you to help me. If somebody starts to infringe on my brand, let me know, bring me the appropriate information. I'll go to the registrar with your information because I have high confidence you're not going to come and tell me that this domain is phishing when it's not. And I think that those are valuable, and the people who do those have very high reputation marks. So I think we need to study those and come up with one for the industry so that registrars have a relatively high confidence. And I think we can complement that with some sort of safe harbor mechanisms that allow registrars to take an action without an enormous amount of of liability and risk of a false positive.
Well, this is Mikey. I'm done. Thanks, Dave. I'm really glad I asked those questions. That was terrific.
Michael Collins had a question, I think.
Yes, but Tim's ahead of me, I think.
Okay, well, I'll do the two M's first, and then we can go to the T.
Okay, very good. My first question, I'll wait to ask a follow-up possibly. And it's really of the group as much as of Dave. Are we within our charter to be dealing with registrant changes? Obviously, it's not the same as a registrar transfer for the registrant to be changed or the name servers to be changed. And it's not that I don't think these things are important and should be dealt with, but I just wonder if we were if that's included in our in where we should be. Or is this a security issue that's outside of inter-registrar transfer issues? And the second is I'll let the group answer that.
This is Tim. I'll comment on that if it's okay.
Please, Tim.
Yeah, I think it's okay to look at that. When you look at the different at what's in our charter and the questions being asked, I mean, in reality, they all have an effect on the registrant. And I think that in many cases, that's really what our primary concern is, you know, making this process safe and secure and understandable and easy to use as possible by the registrant. So I think those are valid questions to ask. And, you know, whether we're able to, that might affect the ability to actually have a policy to some extent, because, you know, we have to take into account various registrants' needs and that type of things. But I think those are valid questions to ask. You know, what's the effect on the registrant, or how do we make things, how do we educate the registrant, and those types of questions I think are important.
Sorry.
This is Mikey. I'd like to comment on Michael's question, too. I think that, to a certain extent, one of the reasons that this is relevant to the inter-registrar transfer group is because a hijacking which immediately moves the domain to a different registrar is a different sort of event than one that the domain stays within the same registrar. I think when it's in the same registrar, it's probably a bit less complicated to deal with. And because we are interested in cross-registrar transfers, that this is relevant.
Just personally, I'd agree with that as well, as Michele speaking. I mean, that if there's changes of what it appears as the registrant, then it will obviously have an impact. I mean, one possible situation is where the registrant details may need to be updated because they're no longer valid. So it could be an employee has moved on, or it could be any number of different reasons, but I still think it's pertinent and it is relevant. Going back to people with their hands up, Michael, I think if you could put your hand down, please. Tim Ruiz, you wanted to jump in there?
Right. Thanks, McKelly. Not so much questions, I guess, is just two concerns I wanted to point out that I feel we need to keep in mind. One, and Dave sort of touched on, and that's the safe harbor concept. I think that's going to be important to registrars when we're talking about, providing, an entity or a process that they can rely on in order to take action on quickly. That a lot of, the time that it takes and the concerns that registrars have with doing things much faster, a lot of that centers around just doing due diligence to make sure that they're doing the right thing and protecting themselves from potential legal risks later. And those shouldn't be underestimated. They can be huge, especially when we're talking about, the high-profile sites or sites that there's a high amount of traffic and reliance on. If we do the wrong thing, I mean, there's a huge potential risk involved with that. So that needs to be kept in mind as we move forward with any recommendations.
What's the safe harbor concept you're talking about?
Well, in other words, some sort of protection from a registrar who takes action so that they're not later, it minimizes to the extent possible the risk that they'll end up in court with some, you know, spending millions of dollars trying to defend themselves over having taken action. That's what I'm really referring to. So, for example, what GoDaddy will do in some cases when we need to transfer a name back and we, you know, working something out directly with the registrar involved is indemnifying one way or the other registrar in order to make that happen without having to go through the dispute process, which would take much longer. So registrars are kind of doing that between themselves. Some are more inclined to do that than others. So that's not a perfect solution, but it's just an example of one of the things that's going on. The other issue that I want to point out is just the volume that some registrars have to deal with, and this probably affects GoDaddy perhaps more than anybody else, but I can't imagine, you know, it doesn't affect registrars like 2000 Enom and others, network solutions. But just giving an example, when it comes to transfers in and transfers out, we deal with one of those every 30 seconds on average. So, you know, that's the volume that we're talking about. So things like, you know, calling people on phones to verify this or that gets to be, you know, a bit problematic. We practically have to double our staff just to deal with something like that, especially when that's just transfers. I mean, then, you know, we register new domain names like every 1 or 2 seconds, but then that doesn't even include the millions of transactions that take place that involve, you know, changing name servers, contact details, et cetera, et cetera. So the volume can get quite high, and that's not just GoDaddy. I think you'll find that with other registrars as well, even though there may be somewhat less volume, it still stacks up when you talk about the number of transactions involved. So that needs to be kept in mind, too, as we think about possible solutions or recommendations that might solve some of these problems.
Tim, this is Mikey. I have a follow-up for you. Do you have a sense of the frequency with which contested inter-registrar transfers happen? At first I thought you meant one of those every 30 seconds, and then I realized that didn't mean that.
No, that's probably some information we can get. I think we were trying to gather some data on that. I'm not going to speak to it. I think James has been kind of working on that. I'm not sure he's prepared to either yet today. I think the overall volume is important because if when we're talking about measures that might preempt the possibility of a problem occurring. So I think there's two issues. One is, you know, okay, something happens. Now let's get to a quick resolution. And that's where, you know, I think some of the indemnification issues need to be dealt with. And then other things we've talked about or that David talked about, too, dealt with things that could be done up front to prevent a problem from happening. And that's where we have to think about the volume of transactions that are occurring at various registrars.
Yeah, and I agree. This is Dave Piscitello again. One of the things I want to be certain people understand about the SAC document number 40 is that these are measures that we suggest registrars, you know, consider for customers who are seeking, you know, better protection. There might be at some future point in time an SAC document that says, you know, the overall security baseline could be improved by doing X, where X might be a different list. But right now we're saying that there are companies that either through lack of understanding or lack of available services might benefit from having additional measures. But certainly automation and dealing with, you know, with transactions, you know, in high volume that are, you know, atomic events that occur in virtually seconds is, you know, has to be a factor in a service that scales to, you know, to serving millions of users, you know, with millions of transactions per day or week or even month.
Okay, James, you had your hand up. Do you want to jump back in?
Thanks, and I think Tim and Mikey covered a lot of my questions, so I'll go ahead and lower my hand at this point. I did have a new question that just kind of popped into my head there for Dave, relative to the FSAC report in 2005 and FSAC 40. And this question, probably by extension, goes out to Barbara and Eric and any of the other registry reps on the call. What is the role of the registry in transfer security in general? How do they view themselves as a disinterested observer or taking what the registrars give them on face value, or is there some sort of a at least a detection and notification if there's anything amiss with the transfer patterns? And I'm just curious as if this is solely a registrar-focused issue or if there's some role for registries as well.
This is Barbara. I'll jump in here. From our perspective, I would consider us more of an innocent bystander, if you will, to the extent that a registrar submits a transfer request to the registry and provides the auth info code in order to validate that. And again, this is strictly registrar to registrar transfers because, you know, here at VeriSign, obviously, we don't see any registrant information, so we have no visibility into that. And then basically if there is an issue that arises, you know, we do get involved if somebody submits a transfer dispute case relating to a registrar-to-registrar transfer. So I would almost view this more as an issue that is, I'm not going to say it's exclusive to registrars, but I would say that it is primarily impacting to registrars. Obviously, the registrars also own the relationship with the registrant. At the registry, we obviously can look at you know, rolling out new products that may help to secure at least you know, a VeriSign, you know, name server changes, things like that, that we could work in conjunction with registrars on. But beyond that, you know, strictly registrar to registrar transfers is all we really see. And so long as there is a an auth info code, we trust that the registrar that's submitting the transfer has done the due diligence on their end to make certain that it's a valid transfer.
Thanks, Barbara. This is James again. I kind of suspected that was the case, but I was curious as if that, I mean, if you guys feel the same about any sort of a hypothetical urgent return process and what whether the registries would also play a role in that.
I do have a question because one of the things I'm curious about is, you know, is, yeah, the extremely high profile domain, the eBay or the PayPal or the Microsoft.com or dot whatever. It seems to me that if I were Microsoft and my name were, you know, were transferred, I would probably have attorneys calling, you know, calling the registries as well as the, you know, the registrars involved. Now, so Barbara, are you saying that in those circumstances, you just put yourself at arm's distance and let the registrars resolve it, or in something that exception based, would you envision a registry, not necessarily COM, taking a more proactive action?
It obviously is handled on a case by case basis. And depending on, you know, the status of the name, if you will, and the level of attention it gets, you know, it's going to determine, you know, what actions we would take. You know, before we take any action on a name, we would prefer to see a court order or some similar mechanism instructing us as to what to do with the name. You know, from our perspective, we're a little different because we don't have any visibility into registrant information. We would obviously reach out to the registrars to engage them to see, you know, what they're doing on their end to try to validate the situation. One of the things that we did do recently is we had submitted an RCEP application for a service that we call Registry Lock that we're looking at rolling out, which would allow registrars to enter into a contract with us to submit, you know, their higher profile names for us to basically lock them down here at the registry, and it would require any changes that, you know, we can control here at the registry. The registrars would have to contact us and provide basically two-factor authentication in order to unlock the name to allow any changes to occur to the name. So
yeah, I confess I was fishing for you to talk about that. So.
I'm not surprised, but yes, I mean, that is it has been approved at the RCEP, so we are looking at implementing that service.
This is Mikey. As soon as it's rolled out, somebody please email me. I'd like to sign up for that.
I'll keep you posted, Mikey.
Thanks a lot.
Sure.
This is Tim. Can I have a comment on that? I think what Barbara just described that in that RSS report, I think that's personally, I think that's an excellent idea. And because actually, you know, some of the registries are doing that already, but it's kind of a little bit of an ad hoc process, and so this will actually kind of formalize that, and I think it's an excellent idea. Of course, that doesn't completely solve some of the problems, because on the registrar's end, there's still, I think we still need to discuss, what can the registrar do to ensure that when they're making that request, they've done whatever due diligence is necessary to make sure that, what they're asking is appropriate. That some of the issues we talked about, such as, identity of the registrant and those kinds of things, I think it will still be important.
Well, this is Mikey. I want to chime in on that, because I think what we're probably going to find the most difficult cases to deal with are the less prominent domains, sort of the small business person who isn't very sophisticated, doesn't have very good security, and finding the balance between their culpability as opposed to a process change that we can make.
Yeah, this is Tim. I agree with that, too. I think, that while some of these high-profile cases, like panics, for example, whatever, while the total dollar value of what's at risk or the total hurt that's caused is very painful, I think that with some of the smaller customers that it could potentially be devastating, even though, the dollar amount of the total harm might quantify much less, that the overall harm done to that individual could be totally devastating. So ideally, having a process that secures things better for everyone, I think is important. But certain high-profile sites, I think, will be, clearly might be, some different factors that could be come into play there or used for those. But yeah, you're right. We shouldn't forget about, the average user.
I'm just taking off my hat as the chair here. I mean, I would be very much in favor of policies that benefit everybody, not just a select few. I mean, the example of Microsoft is perfect. Microsoft is economically in a position to hire a massive team of lawyers. Microsoft is in a position to have dedicated staff to look after whatever domains they may have to deal with. Your average SME, which in our terms would be with fewer than about 100 staff, isn't going to have that opportunity. Yet, if something were to happen to their domain name, that could be completely disastrous to them, and in the grand scheme of things, could have a much more negative impact on them, on their business, than the impact that eBay might feel if they lost control of their domain for 2 hours. For that small business. So, the fear I would have is that a lot of these reports talk about these very high-profile cases, but the reality is that a lot of the high-profile companies are in a much better position to take measures to secure their domains compared to your normal average user who's paying GoDaddy or Enom or whoever less than $10 a year for a domain name. I think people should keep that in focus. Just my personal comment. Dave, go ahead.
Yeah, I actually have to leave in about 10 minutes for another call, but I just wanted to ask a question, if I might, about the report dated 15 May 2009 that Marika forwarded to me. There's a section 2.4 that talks about the ESAC 2005 report, and then it goes on to list some possible elements of an urgent restoration. I think that these are actually still relevant and still and ESAC would still be very
very satisfied if this were the direction that this working group would take, and in particular the discussion about the policy to the action channel and the kinds of information that is provided here. And what I want to do is encourage those registrars who and members of this group who haven't had an opportunity to look at the accelerated suspension work from the APWG to sort of look at that for some other models for what kind of information is appropriate, who would collect it, maybe establishing some criteria for magnitude of harm, and I think that this is all heading in what I would I personally believe is a very positive direction, because there are two essential components here. You want as much corroborating information as possible, and someone that you trust providing that information to further reinforce the confidence that the action you're taking is appropriate. And I think if you can model a response around those two first principles, you probably will have a resolution process, an urgent resolution process that would work in a very large percentage of the cases with a very small incidence of false positives. If you complement that with some kind of safe harbor from liability because the registrars are acting in good faith, I think you have as good a response as any industry can possibly provide.
Okay, thanks, Dave. Anil George has your hand up.
Ellie, I just wanted to say that I agree with your recent point that, probably our focus should be on the community as a whole, and we probably should not be sort of distracted by the fact that the parties involved in some of the reports may be very high-profile entities. I think the issue is that this is probably a problem that can affect many different organizations.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments? No? Okay, Dave, do you have to run off now?
I have like 5 minutes, so I don't have to be precisely off at 11, but if there's something else that you want to ask...
Well, one thing I was going to ask you about, I mean, it's based on the report. There was some mention, I think, about security regarding registrars and about some possible commonly accepted standard. I think it may be mentioned in during Sydney. I mean, are there any recognized security certifications that the SEC would recommend, or ones that the SEC would think are a total waste of time, or is there anything in that area that you could talk to?
Are you talking specifically about voluntary security auditing?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, this is a bit orthogonal from the IRTP discussion, but, prior to being being a member of SAC and joining ICANN, I was a security consultant, and one of the groups of people that I would typically run into and either engage as part of a larger process were companies that did what are called risk and vulnerability assessments, sometimes the euphemism penetration testing, was applied to especially people who are essentially one-off companies, individuals with a high profile who are very, very skilled in figuring out how to break into networks. That whole space has evolved to a much more sophisticated area of both software and service development that ranges from web application testing all the way up to entire security auditing. The idea that ESSAC was espousing or promoting was one that that sort of follows a trend. If a registrar decides that it wants to distinguish itself as providing, you know, better than average, you know, security measures for its customers. One of the things that it might want to do is go to a company like a Foundstone or go to the ISACA, the Independent Security Auditors, it's ISACA.org, and look to see, you know, what their criteria are and whom they actually you know, use to or what metrics they use to assess the security competency of an organization. And so there's kind of an entire, you know, spectrum of things you can do, from having somebody simply scan your portal to see if there are, you know, SQL insertion vulnerabilities and exploits, to having someone come in and do a, you know, an on-site complete physical audit, complete business audit, complete operational audit, where they, you know, they look at all your systems, they look at your processes and your workflows, and they try to exploit, try to expose where you might be exploited. So they might conclude that you have rock-solid hardware, but your staff are susceptible to social engineering, and the process, you know, has a flaw at this particular point in the workflow where there's an escalation because there's a handoff that's not particularly clean with regard to the information passed from first tier to second tier during the escalation process. And those are quite extensive, and I suspect at this point in time they're quite expensive. But if you're going into the, if you're going to step up from being what, you know, what everyone perceives to be a consumer register, a consumer-oriented registrar, to being a, you know, a registrar that Fortune 100 companies should be willing to throw tens of thousands of dollars per domain at, you know, for security, then that's something you might want, you know, want to consider.
Okay, thanks. Does anybody have any other comments, or can we move on to the next item on the agenda? Okay, I'll take that as a no then. Okay, the next item on the agenda, and I've now ended up in window hell where I've got windows open all around me and I've no idea where I am. Okay, the public comment announcements. Marika, do you want to have anything? Do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, I posted a first draft to the mailing list, I think last week, and there hasn't been any comments or any suggestions, I think, on the mailing list. I don't know if that's because people haven't had a chance to look at it or whether they are fine with the text as is. So the question is, do people need some more time to review and make edits or suggestions on the mailing list or now on the call? Or are people fine with the text as it currently stands?
Well, I'll be honest and say that I can't recall reading it, so I would say I'd have to look at it again. Has anybody else got anything to say about the document that Marika sent around?
This is Mikey. I read it and thought it was fine.
How was the language? Was the language very clear and understandable for normal people, or was it very jargon-laid?
IRTP is sort of by its nature going to be a bit jargon-laden. Given that caveat, I thought it was fine.
Okay. Has anybody else got any other comments for Marika?
Michaela, what I can suggest is maybe recirculate it to the list and give everyone until Friday to provide any edits or comments, and then have the public comment forum opened on Monday if there are no major changes.
That's out
for everyone.
I like that idea. Anybody have any comments on that idea? No. Okay. So if you wouldn't mind resending that, please. And the constituency statement template. Did you send around a draft on that already, or?
I think that was enclosed in the same email, and I actually presume that the same applies to that one. So I'm happy to recirculate that and.
Send it as a separate email if you wouldn't mind, because I think. If the way I handle mail is probably not similar to other people, if you send me two attachments, I'm likely to read one, not the second one.
Okay, I'll send them in two separate emails. I think probably the bigger question on the constituency statement template is do people want to ask more detailed questions or sub questions to the charter questions to the constituencies, or do they feel that it's fine with just putting the charter questions out there and have constituencies add information as they be appropriate, that we might not be asking for, but they might see relevant for the discussion.
This is Mikey. I sort of like in these first rounds to throw as broad a net as possible, sort of an information gathering round. So I would lobby for open-ended questions wherever we can. It's not something I feel super strongly about. It's just I find those useful.
Any other comments? Anybody else have anything else on that?
So again, I can resend that, and people have until the next call to provide any comments, and maybe on the next call we can decide to send it out, and because I think we'll give constituencies anyway some time to look at these and come back to us.
Okay. Now the definitions and concepts. I think I saw some emails about that earlier today, though I have been very bold today in mixing up mailing lists, so I think I sent an entire group of people the wrong email. I think, Mikey, were you sending stuff about definitions there earlier?
This is Mikey. I did, although I confess that was from a very old thread, and I'm not sure that it was sent to this.
No, that was a different working group.
Yeah, that was the other group.
Pulled up the email on the Adobe Connect. It's James that has launched a discussion or put up some first suggestions, and I think there have been some responses to that, but probably James is in a better position to summarize and indicate where changes might be required following the feedback received on the mailing list.
James?
Thanks, very good. Michele, yes. Based on one of my takeaways from our previous call was to try and put some language around some various concepts or types of transactions, and some of these are often mistakenly referred to as transfers when in fact they are distinct and separate operations. There's been a few responses on the list, mostly clarification questions, so I don't know that these definitions or at least these proposed definitions have been changed or modified significantly since they were originally posted. But I didn't know if you wanted to go through these now, Michele, or if you just wanted to...
Well, how are people doing for time? I mean, this is obviously the other question I'd have to ask. I mean, are we all okay
for
time?
Barbara, I'm going to actually have to jump off here in a minute.
Okay.
I had expected the call to run about an hour.
Okay. Well, I mean, look, maybe we can just try to be a little bit more diligent in following up on emails that James sends the list then, I suppose. And yes, I admit I have sinned as well. James, if you want to, you put up that, I think Marika's put up that email that you sent around about your shopper, customer, registrant and everything else. I mean, if people want to have a look over what James has done so far, and if anybody has any input to share with the list. Olaf, you have your hand up.
Yeah, and that was in particular regarding one of the definitions, and it's a detailed comment. I would like to see some direct reference to a registered name holder in the definition of customer, but I can take that on the list.
Yeah, if you wouldn't mind, Olaf, sorry, it's probably easier to thrash these things out in writing in some respects. What was the last thing there? On the agenda there as well, Marika, the soul thing, where are we at with that?
Yes, just most of you confirmed that you would be either participating remotely or on site, so my suggestion would be to go ahead with the proposed meeting time, which is a Monday morning local time at 7 o'clock. so we can take advantage of having a broader community there, and you know, the group might want to throw out specific questions or just have, you know, a normal working group meeting and allow for the last half of the meeting for discussion and open debate, or, I mean, the group can decide how they would like to use that meeting closer to the time.
So what time of the day did we end up with?
Monday morning at 7 o'clock. Breakfast will be provided, including strong coffee.
Okay, as long as you have strong coffee for me. Okay, so stupidly early in the morning in Seoul.
Yes.
Okay.
I'll be jet lagged anyway, so, yeah, morning, evening, you know.
Okay, you might be jet lagged. I'll probably be hungover.
Well, it gives you the same sensation, though.
No comment. Beg your pardon?
One of those Olaf cheaper.
Olaf, you have your hand up again.
Oh, no. I mean, I should have lowered it. Sorry for that.
Well, that's okay. I also have the same problem with it as well. I keep forgetting. Tim.
Yes, we just a couple things I thought maybe that might be helpful to have on the wiki. One, for perhaps for issue A, we could include a link for that SAC report 40 so that we'd all have an easy way to access that for reference, and others who may come into the group later would make it easier for them to get familiar. The other thing I thought I'd mention is just there's another report, SAC 38, or SACO 38, that we might also want to consider and link to. It talks about abuse contacts for registrars, and I think that's going to be something we'll probably end up discussing at some point potentially. So I would suggest at least that maybe the group review that. The new RAA actually requires a contacting published on registrar's website. This goes into a little bit more in depth about 24/7 contact for abuse purposes and the reasons for that, et cetera. So we're talking about, quick resolution of some of these problems. That might be something that we'll want to discuss.
Okay, thank you.
This is Marika. The link to the SAC 40 report is already there, but I'll create a separate section on something like useful documents or documents for review and include as well the SAC 38 there.
Oh, okay, thank you.
And if there's other things as well, I mean, if there's other people who you feel should be part of the working group, I mean, try and get encourage people who are going to actually participate to join. So I think I saw at least one other registrar expressing an interest earlier today. Tim? Oh, you've taken it down. Has anybody got anything else to add at this time?
Maybe just to add that the next meeting will be in 2 weeks, as discussed on the last call. So
yep, perfect.
15th of September.
Okay. In that case, if nobody's got anything else to add, I'd say like just to say thanks again to Marika and our other ICANN staff. Oh, Michael Collins has his hands up. Go ahead, Michael.
I'll be brief. Is there a link to the email communications, a single place that we could review the email that we talked?
Yes, there are. If you go to the GNSO homepage, there's on the left-hand side, I think, a link called Mailing List Archives, and there you should be able to find the IRTP Part B Mailing List Archive. There's also a link on the wiki, I think, and if not, I'll definitely post it there as well.
Looking on the wiki, I didn't see it. I would ask you to post it there if you would, please. Or tell if I missed it, that's fine. Thank you.
Michele and Michael, it's Paul. I just put the link to the archive on our on this Adobe site.
Yep. Perfect. There. Thanks, Paul. So it's just in there in the chat window. Okay, then. So if there's nothing further, and if Marika's going to post a couple of those documents to the list, and if anybody wants to rip James's list of definitions to shreds, please do so on the list. Okay, then. So thanks to everybody, and I'll speak to you, we'll speak all again in 2 weeks' time.
Thanks, McKaylee. Great call.
Thanks, McKaylee.
Thanks,
everyone. Thanks.